Had we known what kind of week this would have been, this might have been a different topic. If I get a little misty-eyed over how tremendous this week was, it's partly because of Lori and Shireen and the role they played in the legal battle that led to this glorious day. One of the nice things about getting old is it's more okay to cry. Earlier this month, when I was putting together this topic, I read in the Statesman that profound advice column known as the Daily Horoscope. Even though about 1/12 of the population share my birth sign, the advice seemed meant just for me. It said, accept the changes going on or reject them. They're going to happen either way. Well, that narrows the options. It set me thinking about the elders that I have met and known, though that group is getting smaller and smaller as I age. First of all, I had to face the fact that I am one of them. And this may shed some light on the view that I've developed in recent years, that elders ought to be highly respected. Secondly, it made me think of the kinds of elders I have known and how they generally fall into two broad categories. And thirdly, I had to ask why they sort themselves into these two general groups. Like most of us, ever since childhood, I have known old people. Some of them I liked very much, even loved, and some not so much. When my parents finally had to enter an assisted living facility, I experienced all the mixed emotions one might expect, feeling badly, even guilty, on not being able to continue caring for them on our own. My sister Melva and family had looked after them for a long time when they could look after themselves. And when Kathy and I moved to Idaho, we helped regularly. But eventually, 24-hour care was required. Fortunately, we found a wonderful facility that fit their personalities, and we were all able to visit them several times a week. Their room was in a complex of 10 residents, not counting a couple of cats and dogs some residents brought with them, and we got to know them all. We often held bingo contests with prizes from the dollar store. When I called the numbers, somehow everyone won at least one game. How that happened will remain a secret. We even cooked a Thanksgiving dinner for the residents and their families several times. Being involved at this facility allowed me to get to know the very elderly in ways I had not when I met folks older than me in social settings, such as church or other events. I got to see them on their own turf, so to speak. And this is when I saw the two broad categories that elderly seem to sort themselves into. One group had become gracious, glad to see any of us visit and join in what was sometimes a rather one-sided conversation. They were happy and content, and a few were pleased to make our acquaintance for the first time, sometimes twice a week. Others made all visitors part of their families and asked after us when we were not there, as often as they would like. But the other group had become rigid and unhappy, and sometimes seemingly determined to be unhappy. They complained about everything. Nothing was right, and no one ever did enough for them. They were hard on the staff, and even annoyed when relatives of someone else visited. These individuals had lived long lives, and now they were brittle. One could say that they were set in their ways, but that has two meanings. One meaning is that they like certain routines, often stretched or even violated in a group setting. I like tea first thing in the morning, followed by coffee. A trick of mixing drinks I picked up on a trip to India long ago. I prefer to shower first, then brush my teeth. We all have such routines. But most of us can forego these routines when circumstances require. The brittleness I saw in some elders went much deeper. It seemed to be a flat rejection of aging, of not controlling everything around one's personal environment, of not being able to make things happen just the way one once did, unable to think of anything except in terms of oneself. The first kind of rigidity was understandable and subject to some degree of accommodation. The second kind was just sad. We can't turn the biological clock back to other times. Note, this is not a judgment. I don't know their life stories, just an observation. It is as if one group matured and the other somehow stagnated. As times and conditions change, and as one gets older, those changes become increasingly intolerable for some, and the result is brittleness. I've thought a lot about aging since it's been happening to me. I try to ignore birthdays, but they refuse to ignore me. So I've had to ask what maturity is and how one gets it. It would be nice to age graciously. Much of the world knows the two great maxims carved in stone at the seat of the oracle at Delphi. Know yourself was one. Nothing in excess was the other. Nothing in excess seems sort of straightforward. But know yourself is more difficult. What is it to know oneself? Somehow it seems more than to know one's habits, preferences, opinions, wishes, and goals. If we can use that maligned and undefined term, it seems to mean that we should know our souls. And how do we do that? Frank Holt wrote about Bactria, the ancient Greek kingdom in present-day Afghanistan. Bactria was the result of Alexander the Great's conquest of Asia up to India, and it lasted a couple of centuries. An inscription there explained that the following was also inscribed at Delphi. As a youth, be self-controlled. As an adult, be just. As an elder, be wise. As one dying, be without regrets. Although the inscription is simple, it packs a lot to think about. We know the Greek idea of justice was not the Roman legalistic sense of abiding by the laws. The Greek virtues, including justice, were qualities of character. And being just meant something close to what we mean by fair-mindedness. But being self-controlled and being wise are not so easily understood. Of course, being fair-minded is not all that easy. The Hindu tradition has a view of life's progression that is similar but more expansive. In that view, life has four stages. The first is brahmacharya, often called the student stage. Brahmacharya literally means chastity, but the idea is learning to control oneself. When to go with all the enthusiasm of childhood and when to mind one's manners. It is the learning phase in which is not just schooling, but includes, more importantly, learning about oneself and others, what to watch out for and restrain in oneself, and how to interact positively with others. The second stage is grihastha, the householder stage, in which one exercises one's responsibility as a father or mother and as a member of the community. This is a long stage, and it has become longer in societies where the average lifespan has been increasing. The third stage is vanaprastha, literally forest dweller, the stage when one withdraws from those responsibilities and takes the time to reflect on the meaning of all one has experienced. Former President Jimmy Carter, in his book, The Virtues of Aging, quotes Jimmy Townsend, a wonderful mountain philosopher, as saying, experience is what you've got plenty of when you're no longer able to hold the job. But the vanaprastha stage is more than loss. It is withdrawal in order to make something of all that experience. What has it taught one? What does it mean? The Hindu view emphasizes individual growth and development, but that always occurs in a social and community context. So the fourth stage is that of sannyasi, literally asceticism, but meaning detachment from the pushes and pulls of desires, hopes, and wishes, and includes acceptance of life and willingness to help others become wise. In village life, a person, male or female, in this stage is likely to be asked to arbitrate disputes and conflicts, mediate reconciliation, nurture cooperation, and peaceful interactions with respect for all. It is assumed that the sannyasin, an individual in this stage, does not have a hidden agenda, is not concerned for himself or herself, and is looking for the betterment of the community. This wisdom is manifest in a great deal of compassion. We call this wisdom a kind of objectivity, and compassion is its practice. As Stephen Hall, no relation, says in his fascinating book, Wisdom from Philosophy to Neuroscience, and that's a key point, to separate wisdom from action is a form of malpractice in the conduct of life. In this view, elders are honored not for their age, but for their accomplishments beyond raising families and having careers. They are expected to earn that honor by coming to understand themselves, the lives lived, and the deep knowledge of life gained and now shared. All this seems built into that cryptic Greek inscription, the last line of which is, "As one dying, be without regrets." If one successfully negotiated all these stages, there would be no regrets. This is not because one made no mistakes or errors, but because one assimilated lessons from them and learned how to be a better person in oneself and as a member of the community. Those rigid elderly folks in assisted living who made such an impression on me seem never to have entered that third stage of deep reflection on life, and so could not function well in the changed circumstances in which they found themselves. They had much they could have taught the much younger staff, but instead became little more than annoyances to be endured. The staff was excellent at endurance, and so they learned something, of course. In the Hindu view and the Greek inscription, the whole of life is a kind of spiritual discipline. Becoming a wise individual is a life work, and it serves both self and others. But getting there is hardly easy. The Greek inscription is a guideline and says nothing about how we mature. The Hindu model is a template, an ideal, and life circumstances will, of course, affect how it works in practice. Although vanaprastha is the forest dweller stage, few people headed for the hills. Rather, withdrawal was thought to be an attitude of mind, and that could occur within one's own home. At the same time, those who reach the sannyasi stage and who lived without attachment to anything, often changing their names and living detached from friends and family, are still fed in shelters by the government in many places. Even without being a detailed program for life, the four stages at least offer insight into what a maturing individual is trying to do. But as many thinkers and commentators have observed, we do not live life in a traditional society in which the community as a whole supports the individual's development. As individuals, we resist being told what to do and how to be. Rather, we celebrate the freedom to explore ourselves and our world, to become what we wish to be. Unitarian Universalists have always been in the front ranks of this celebration. Just look at our seven principles. We see each as a mystery to be revered and explored, but never fully penetrated. The Delphic maxim, know yourself, refers to a process, not an end state. Traditional societies, hidebound as some can seem to be, cannot completely rule individual lives, but provide guideposts and criteria for measuring progress. We have moved beyond such things because we have become only too aware of their oft-times coercive nature. But there is a price to be paid for this freedom from architectonic plans for life. As the Canadian novelist Robert Davies put it in one of his novels, one always learns one's mystery at the price of one's innocence. When we look at traditional societies, especially deeply religious ones, we can see life as a spiritual development. But we may fail to notice that the rejection of life templates, the loss of guideposts from common beliefs to common manners and dress, maturing becomes an even more intense spiritual discipline. Part of me would like to be a theist. Part of me would like to be a polytheist, and a part pantheist. Earth-centered spirituality calls to me, as does scientific rationalism and the atheism it often entails. So I might prefer to be an agnostic. A recent New Yorker cartoon lists prayers for agnostics. One begins, "Heavenly whatever, on the off chance you're there." And another opens with, "To the powers that might or might not be." And finally, my favorite, "Sorry in advance for being so bad at believing, but..." But this is not satisfying. What do we do when the guideposts no longer avail? Individual search and self-determination require connection with the whole for both meaning and support. We need help being ourselves. Surely that is why the seven principles begin with the worth and dignity of each individual and ends with the interdependent web of all existence. No wonder we speak of beloved community. So what is maturity? It seems to be something like this. As we grow, we learn categories to put people and events in so that we may know how to respond. Yet as we mature, our discernment increases, and our judgments become less and more tentative. We learn that there is always more to the story. Eventually, if we have engaged in life as a spiritual discipline, as a place to learn and grow and bloom, we withdraw from agendas of self-promotion and self-protection, gaining critical distance from ourselves and our own wishes, and think more in terms of the whole. Even as we have to take greater care of ourselves physically, mentally and emotionally, we turn toward the community and our part in nurturing it. This is the paradox of maturity. As we age, we must look after ourselves more carefully, since we become more fragile. But we concern ourselves more with others and their welfare, contributing what we can to the beloved community. If we stop this process, say, after we have learned to categorize and summarize what we see and do, our judgment becomes judgmentalism, our convictions rigid certainties, and our maturation stops. But in the words of the reading, if we don't stop, we gradually become more like water, reaching the recesses and crevices of life. We judge less and appreciate more. We react less and understand more. We develop character, which is less about what we do than it is about how we do it. Old age is hardly all smooth and pleasant, but it can be rich, rewarding, and fulfilling. And when the sunset comes, despite all that has happened, there need be no regrets. May it be so.